or a phone that looked just like it. Another burner could have been programmed with everything my son's phone contained, easy enough since all he had in it were phone numbers and texts. It could have been cloned, just as Prester had demonstrated, the history copied over, even the number replicated. And what came back into our house could have been a different phone, a phone that could listen to us, a camera that could see us when left out. I thought about that phone sitting next to Connor's bed, learning about our habits, our patterns, what time Connor got up and went to bed. It might have been able to record the tones and figure out our passcode, though maybe that one had been the easiest of all. Maybe Officer Graham had simply watched me enter it that night when he first came over. Something cracks inside me, just a little. I feel the first violent pulse of panic as the shock begins to let go, as the bleeding starts. I close my eyes and try to keep thinking, because this is the most important moment of my life. The silence is heavy in the SUV. The excellent noise canceling dims the roar of the rain to a dull, monotonous hiss, like the screaming of distant stars. There are no other cars behind us on the road, no friendly, glaring headlights approaching. We might be the only two people alive in the world. My phone buzzes again. I position the coat so it covers my phone and read the second text. We are at NPD. Where are you? It's from Sam Cade. He's not on the mountain, searching. This whole trip has been a lie. My phone is on silent, so it makes no noise as I carefully, slowly type my reply. Graham has me. I'm hitting send when the truck lurches wildly sideways, and next thing I know, I'm being knocked hard against the passenger door. My phone goes flying, and from the last glimpse I have, I can't tell if the text sent or not. I grab for it. Graham reaches for it at the same time, and as he does, he deliberately, I think, smashes it hard against one of the metal struts under the seat. The glass stars obscuring the screen. The power sputters out. Shit, he says, holding it up. Shakes it as if he can magically reset it. It's excellent theater. He even looks concerned, and if I wasn't so terrified now, so angry, I'd have believed that, too. I try to slow the pounding of adrenaline into my bloodstream, because I don't need it now. I need to think. I need to plan before I can act. Let him think he's got me. I have to kill this man. But first I have to find out where he's taken my kids. So slowly, very slowly, I pull the weight of my backpack up. The hiss of the rain and road noise may disguise the sound of the zipper pulling. My hands are shaking badly from the terror and the rapid-fire pulse of my heart. I feel around inside the opening and touch fingers to the pebbled plastic of the gun case. It's turned the wrong way. I need to move it to get access to the lock. Lancel Graham is looking mournfully at the broken phone. God damn it, I'm sorry about that. Look, they probably are getting copies of the calls at the station. Want me to check? He doesn't wait for a response. He takes out his own cell phone and seems to make a call. The screen lights up. It looks legitimate. But for all I know, he's talking to a recording. Hey, Kez, I just fucked up Miss Proctor's cell phone. Yeah, I know. Dropped it like an idiot. It's busted all to hell. Listen, are her calls being intercepted? Recorded? He glances at me and smiles in what looks like real relief. Good, that's good. Thanks, Kez. He thumbs it off. No worries. They're monitoring the calls. Kez will call me if there's any news about your kids, okay? It's all pure theater. He damn sure hasn't called the police station. The gun case is heavy inside the backpack. If I make too obvious a move, he'll punch me, and one solid hit from a man this size in close quarters might put me down. I have to control my fear. I have to. I work to inch the case up and turn it sideways. It seems to take forever. I'm praying that Graham can't tell what I'm doing. The gloom's heavy in the car, and we're on a very dark road, but I can see him glancing over. I've managed to turn the case, but this side is the hinges. I need two more turns to get to the lock, and I want to cry. I want to scream. I want to take the backpack and slam it into the side of his head. But there's no advantage to this, not now. Not here, on this deserted road, on this rainy night. I'm sure he's armed. I'm sure his gun is far easier to reach than mine. If I don't keep control, if I react with pure emotion, I will lose. I have to be better at this than a psychopath. We make the turn for Stillhouse Lake. There are no boats out tonight. Lights blaze in almost every house to keep away the dark, the monsters, as we pass. At the turnoff that leads to the Johansson's house, he takes a left up the hill. We pass their driveway, and I see the couple standing in their kitchen, glasses of red wine in their hands, talking as they carry plates to a dinner table. The cozy life of total strangers, that eerie postcard of normality, is gone in the next instant. We keep driving. I see Graham's house off to the right. It's genuinely country, a sprawling ranch house with no pretensions to elegance like the Johansson's modern, sharp-cornered glass monstrosity down the way. It's something generations have built onto, and you can see the differences in brick colors. There's another SUV parked up front, and a couple of trail bikes and one ATV, a medium-sized boat on a tow, ready to be taken down to the lake. All the necessary trappings for a man living the lakefront dream. We keep going past his house. Now the trail gets rough, the suspension bouncing and sloughing in mud as the gravel begins to run out. I've missed my shot. Somehow I really thought he'd stop at his house, and my plans were to bail out, lose myself in the dark, and fire a shot or two into the Johansson's plate glass windows. That would damn sure get them to call 911, even if they wouldn't let me in. But he isn't stopping, and I turn the gun case again, faster, another blank side to my searching fingers. "I dropped Sam off top of this ridge," he tells me. Liar. "The road goes that far, but then it's just game trails from there on. You wanted to catch up to them, right? This is the only way to do it. Sorry about the rough ride." I'm well aware that this man is playing a game with me. His voice is warm and quiet and ever so slightly pleased. I can't tell in the ghostly glow of the dashboard light, but I think he's a bit flushed from his success, enjoying himself but trying not to show it. This is the part he likes, the part where he has control, where he's in charge and his prey doesn't even know how badly things have gone yet. But I know. I'm turning the gun case the last bit when we suddenly hit a huge bump, and the backpack jumps and I lose my grip entirely. God, oh God, no. This is going wrong, very wrong. Lancel Graham reaches down for the backpack, which has become wedged between us. He heaves it up and tosses it in the back seat without any comment at all. I can tell the game's starting to wear thin. I'm out of time. I'm out of time, and I don't have a gun. And my God, he's going to kill me and my children, and he's going to get away with it. I need to act. Now. Does the search team have radios? I ask him, reaching for his police band, which is tucked into the space between us. We should probably find out exactly where. He grabs my hand, and for a second I think, this is it. And I start finding options. I calculate things in fractions of a second. He has one hand on the wheel, one holding my left hand. If I lean across, I can punch him as hard as I possibly can in the balls. His legs are relaxed and open, and it'll give me at least a minute or two. But then what? He's big, and I suspect he's fast. I don't know his pain tolerance, but I know mine. If he wants to stop me, he's going to be in the fight of his life. I need to disable him long enough to get my gun out of the backpack, put it together, and shoot until he tells me where my kids are, then shoot him again until he's gone from the face of this earth. There's a shotgun in the rack behind me. I see it from the corner of my eye, like a long metal exclamation point. I can also see the padlock shivering as the truck bounces. The shotgun is firmly locked in place. No help. I'm ready to move, to let loose with everything I have, when Graham lets go of my hand and says, "Sorry, Gwen, it's just that the thing is police property. Can't let you use it on your own like that." It's just enough to stop me. He enters some code with his thumb and switches the radio on. The screen glows an unearthly blue, and he changes to a channel I don't see. "NPD search party 2. Do you read me?" "NPD search party 2, looking for a location. Relay your coordinates." It startles me that he's actually playing this out, and the fear inside me doesn't go away, but it's crowded by doubt. I don't know what the hell he's doing. I blink and draw back, adrenaline bubbling uselessly in my veins, shaking in my muscles. He lets the button go and listens, static, like rain. The SUV hits a deep, muddy patch, and he gives me an apologetic grin as he has to drop the radio to straighten the steering out. Weather sometimes plays hell with these things. Plus, the mountains aren't great for signals. You want to try? Go ahead. I keep my eyes on him as I take the radio, press the switch, and repeat the words. NPD Search Party 2, do you read me? Relay coordinates of your location. I know what he's doing. He's playing with me. The way Mel played with his victims in that workshop, testing me, little cuts to see me bleed. It's exciting to him. There's no reply, of course, only static. I glance at the glowing screen, then out the front window. The rain is obscuring everything, but I can tell that we're approaching the end of the road. Once we hit the ridge, we'll be far, far from anyone. Out here in the rain and the mud, nobody's going to come looking. Just as he's planned. I can't diagnose what's wrong with the radio. Could be that it's on the wrong channel, or that he's done something to the antenna. It's probably useless to me. Useless to even try to. My thought is derailed by a changing frequency of static, and a weak voice says, NPD Search Party 2, Roger. Our coordinates are... It fades out in a renewed wash of noise before I can catch more than two of the numbers. I forget my plans. I press the button. Say again, NPD Search Party 2, say again. Is it possible, somehow, that I've misread all of this? That somehow Graham is really telling the truth? It seems impossible, but I've been wrong, so often these days. Another burst of static, no discernible voice this time. I try again and again, and when I look up, the tilt of the vehicle is changing, and we are on the ridge at the end of the road. Graham brings the truck to a stop under the overhanging branches of a giant tree. The drops that fall from the branches are thicker and more emphatic than the rain beyond, like sharp taps of a hammer. I hear them clearly as he shuts off the engine, pulls the parking brake, and turns toward me. I press the radio button again, but he takes the radio from my hand and turns it off. He puts it in the well between us. No use, he says. Like I said, hard to get a signal. He sounds amused, and I wasn't wrong. I was never wrong at all. Not about the blood, not about his actions. Not wrong about Lancel Graham. He was never talking to a Norton Police Department search team. We're on our own here, Gina, he says. It sounds obscenely like a come-on. I want to scream. I want to punch him in the balls, but he's ready. I can tell he's ready, and I'm not. My name isn't Gina. It's Gwen, I say. Which way did Sam go? I saw the map from Prester. Was he taking the northeast route? I try my door. As I feared, it won't open. Useless. Something dies inside me, that last hope of retreat. I have no choice now. I fight, and I'm scared out of my mind, alone, unarmed, against a much larger man. I can't lose, not for an instant. You don't want to do that, he tells me. You'll just get lost out there, probably break your neck falling down a hill. Hey, I know. I'll call Sam direct. Maybe we can get through. He's still playing the game. I'm not. I pick up the radio and smash it into his temple with as much force as I can manage in the small space, and I hear the scream that rips out of me. It's shatteringly loud in the cabin. My first hit rips a gash in his skin, and blood gushes out, and Lancel Graham screams and flails at the radio as I bash him again and again. No control now, nothing but pure, glorious rage that makes me want to destroy him. The plastic casing splinters. I leave a thick fragment of it embedded in his cheek. He's dazed. I lunge past him to the door control on his side, the one I've been staring straight at, and I hear the heavy thunk as the locks disengage. As I draw back, I slam my fist right down into his balls, and I see him go still as the pain rockets through him. His eyes fix on mine for the second time there, and then I'm moving on before I hear his howl. I grab my backpack from the back seat. I throw my door open and roll out, backpack and coat held tight. His hand closes over the trailing end of the coat and yanks, and the cold mud under my feet gives, and I slide off balance, and panic bolts through me in painful sparks. I can't let him get his hands on me. I let go of the coat, catch myself on the doorframe, and I run. Because this time, I really will feel the monster's breath against my neck. 13. Once I'm in the open, the rain hits me like a cold knife, cutting straight through me. But I don't slow down. I'm panting, nearly blind with terror. But I push that back. I have to think. I've hurt Graham, but I haven't stopped him. I don't know what weapons he has with him. A shotgun, probably a handgun, no doubt knives. I have my Sig Sauer and the scant remains of the ammunition I brought from the gun range. The loss of the coat, I realize, is deadly. The cold front that's pushing through has pulled the temperature down into the 50s, maybe the 40s, and with the damp I can already feel the chill biting, though my fear and rage are coating me in their own special warmth. The mud leaves the ground slippery and uncertain, and I don't know these woods. I'm not native. I'm not military trained like Sam, like Javier. I don't have a prayer. I don't damn well care. I will not lose. I make it to the thick line of undergrowth and thrash through it as fast as I can. I'm collecting cuts and bruises, and I know that running in the dark is a terribly stupid idea. I slow down, feel my way, and avoid impaling myself on a sharply broken branch. I touch it, and then I crouch down and open the backpack. I pull out my gun case and open it. I assemble my gun blind and check the mag. It's empty. I look for the extra rounds in the backpack and realize that the bastards at the NPD must have test-fired nearly everything I had. I load everything into the clip. 7 bullets left. Just 7. It only takes 1, I tell myself. It's a lie, of course. I know it is. Adrenaline keeps people moving, keeps them dangerous, even when they ought to fall down. But that works on my side, too. I am not going to lie down. I am not going to quit. My fear is making me stronger now, alert, weirdly steady. A startling flash of white light blares, and I feel an electric hiss across the hair on my body, and then I hear the ear-shattering boom of the lightning strike. It's on the next hill, and instantly a pine tree is aflame. Half of it topples away, trailing fire. In the light of the flash, I see the dark shape of Graham coming through the undergrowth. He's only about 10 feet away. I have to move. He'll have seen me, too. It's a nightmare lit by the distant flaming tree, underbrush, tree trunks, rain, thick mud sliding underfoot, and clinging hard to my boots and the legs of my jeans. I'm freezing, but I hardly feel it. My entire focus is on moving fast, as safely as possible. I don't know where Graham is. I can't risk a shot until I have a clear, unbroken line of sight. Panic shooting is stupid shooting. And I can't kill him by accident. I need him alive. I need to know where my children are. My job is harder than his, and weirdly, in this moment, I imagine Mel whispering to me, "You can do this. I made you stronger." I hate it, but he's right. I'm halfway up a sloping, slippery trail when I feel the sting of buckshot. It's a hot spray across my left arm, like being hit by boiling water from a fire hose. The shock clamps down quick and sends me dodging, slipping, grabbing for tree trunks to hold myself upright. The sharp, bright smell of burned gunpowder cuts through the rain, and I think, in a kind of genuine surprise, he hit me. The logical part of my mind tells me it isn't bad. It was a glancing blow, not the full power of the shotgun. That would have torn my arm to ribbons. This is inconvenience. I can still move my arm, still grip things. Everything else has to wait. The terror inside me threatens to make me swerve off the path, find a hiding spot and curl up and die, and I can't let it get control. I hear something through the roar of the rain and the distant rumble of thunder. Graham's laughing. I slip behind a thick tree trunk and catch my breath, and as I look back, I catch a lucky bolt of lightning that lights up the trail. He's not far behind me, and he throws up a hand to shield his eyes from the bright flash, and I realize he's wearing night vision. He can see me running through the darkness. I feel a wave of despair. I have 7 bullets to his shotgun, no way to accurately sight my shots in this dark, soaking hell, and he has night vision. I feel it all slipping away from me. I'll never find my children. I'll die out here and rot on this mountain, and no one will ever know who killed me. What steadies me again is a vision of what the Sicko Patrol will make of that fate. Served her right, the bitch. Justice at last. I will never be their victory. I wait while Graham closes the distance. If I'm going to shoot, I'm going to make it good. I can do this. Wait for the lightning flash to blind him again. Step out, open up. He's a paper target on the range, and I can do this. It all happens perfectly. The hot blue-white flash of the lightning lights Graham perfectly, and I aim, smooth and calm now, and just before I squeeze the trigger, I feel the barrel of a shotgun press hard against my neck and hear Kyle Graham, the older son, yell, "I got her, Dad!" Surprise dulls the flash of panic, but I don't think. I just act. I spin to my left, graceful and fast in the mud. Finally, it's working for me. And sweep the barrel away with the edge of my hand, reversing as I go to take a good grip on the metal and twist. While that's in motion, I kick hard into Kyle's groin. I pull it at the last moment, remembering that I'm not fighting a man. He's a boy. Just a boy, about my daughter's age. And it's not his fault his father's a world-class psychopath any more than it's Lanny's fault she is Mel's child. All this is still enough to shock Kyle. He chokes and staggers back, letting go of the shotgun. The weight of it drags at my wounded left arm. I jam the pistol into my jeans pocket, hoping to hell I don't shoot myself, and I shove Kyle hard in the flat of his back. "Run, or I'll kill you!" I scream at him, and the next flash shows him flailing through the underbrush, heading up the hill, not down. I wonder why, but I don't have time to think. I bring the shotgun up and spin toward where his father must be, and I pull the trigger. The weapon's kick nearly knocks me on my ass in the slippery footing, but I manage to catch myself against the thick, moist bark of a pine. The photo flash of the gun igniting showed me that I'd missed him. Not by much, though. Maybe I'd given him a couple of pellet kisses to remember me by. "Bitch!" Graham yells. "Kyle! Kyle!" "I let him go!" I shout back. "Where are my kids? What did you do to them?" I duck behind a tree in the darkness. "You'll be with them soon, you fucking—" Though thunder mutes the sound of the gunshot, I feel the tree shiver slightly as it absorbs the pellets. I wonder how well armed he is. If I can get him to run out of ammunition? But no. Lancel Graham would have planned this as meticulously as everything else. I can't count on something so simple. I realize in the flash of another lightning strike that I'm standing not far from another trail, one that branches off to the west. It seems to wander that way, and I think it slopes down. The lightning has picked up now, and I think it might be enough to lessen the effectiveness of Graham's night vision equipment. He'll have trouble picking me out in all the flashes. I go low, hoping that even if he spots me, he'll think I'm a deer, and I make it to the point where the trail begins to curve down. If I can make it to the ridge, it's possible that Graham's one of those hide-a-key fools, and I can find a magnetic box in the wheel well that will let me steal the thing and get out of here, find help, find my children. He must have GPS, maybe a record of where he's been. I fall halfway down the trail, slide, and my head slams hard into a jutting boulder. Sparks and stars and a wave of icy, tingling pain that makes everything strangely soft. I lie for a moment in the cold rain, gasping, spitting out water like a drowning victim. I'm cold. I'm so cold. And I wonder, suddenly, if I'm going to be able to get up. My head feels strange, wrong, and I know it's bleeding badly. I can feel the warmth running out of me. No, I'm not dying here. I'm not. I don't know if Graham is still tracking me. I don't know anything except that I have to get up. Cold or not, hurt or not. I have to get to the ridge and find a way to get help. Somehow. I will fucking shoot one of the Johansson's prize paintings if I need to make my point. I slip and slide my way to my hands and knees, and I remember that I had a shotgun, but I can't find it now. It's gone, pitched into the darkness by my fall, and there's no way for me to find it now. I still have the pistol, which miraculously hasn't blown a big, devastating hole in my thigh. I take it out of my pocket and hold it tight as I get up and rest against the boulder. Blood is sheeting down the side of my face in a warm torrent that the rain dilutes almost instantly. I slither down the trail, grabbing for handholds. It's a nightmare that I can't escape, this descent, and I form the idea that Graham is right behind me, grinning and taunting. Then Graham morphs into Mel, the Mel behind the plexiglass at the prison, grinning at me with bloody teeth. It feels eerily true, but when I finally, breathlessly twist around, I find that the next flash of lightning shows me there's no one on the trail at all. I'm alone, and I'm nearly to the ridge. As I get to the thick undergrowth that marks the place where the forest clears, something makes me stop and crouch down as I stare through the leaves. I'm aware of my heart beating fast, but it also feels sluggish, weary, as if it might take a nap at any moment. I must have lost more blood than I thought, and the cold is making my body work harder and harder. I'm shaking convulsively. It is, I know, the last step before false warmth sets in and the urge to sleep. I don't have much time left. I need to get to the truck and get Kyle's coat. It'll help me for the next part, the run down the hill. Like it or not, I'm going to have to depend on the Johansons for help. A little flicker of movement by the truck freezes me in place. The rain is lessening a little, though the thick mutter of thunder overhead rolls almost continuously. The easing downpour lets me see a fraction of a curve that shouldn't be there, braced on the far side of the truck and protected by the solid wall of the engine block. It's ahead, and it's too big to be Kyle's. Kyle ran up the hill, not down. Lancel Graham is lying in wait. He's taken a classic ambush predator approach. Watching him, I remember the calm, offhand way that Melvin talked about his process in an interview a few years back. He'd crouch in just that spot by a car and wait for the woman to approach, then attack like a praying mantis in an overwhelming rush. It almost always worked. Graham is a real fanboy. He knows my ex-husband's habits, his moves, his strategies. But he doesn't know me. I survived Melvin. I'm going to survive this asshole, too. I'm not far from the original trail we took up the hill, and I work my way carefully around to it. I position myself exactly right. I hit my mark, and then I hesitate. I'm cold. I'm slow. I'm confused from the head wound. What if this doesn't work? What if he just shoots me? No. He's been hunting me to capture me, not just dispose of a problem. With the night vision he was wearing, he could have cut me in half already. He wants me. He likes games. All right, Lance, let's play a game. I come around a tree, limping, moving slowly. I make sure I look just as miserable and ill as I feel, and as I come into the opening right at the trailhead, I brace myself and slide down to my knees, weak, beaten, in just the right place. I don't look up to see where he is. I just wait, breathing heavily. I try to get up, but not very hard, and then I let myself fall over, left side down in the mud. The pistol's beneath me, concealed where I've rolled forward enough to shade it. It looks like I'm trying to find the strength to rise. I wait. I can't hear him coming over the steady, slowing drum of the rain, but I sense him, almost like a heat source on the edge of my awareness. He's careful. He circles at a distance. I can dimly see him through my eyelashes, smeared by the rain. He's got the shotgun. He circles closer, closer, and then he's there. I see the muddy toes of his boots edge in closer and the hem of his mud-caked jeans. The barrel of the shotgun is aimed not at me, but at the ground between the two of us. He can still kill me. It's a small movement to bring the muzzle up and fire, but he's enjoying this. He likes seeing me beaten. "Stupid, stupid woman," he tells me. "He said you'd fall for this shit." Graham's voice hardens, sharpens. "Get your worthless ass up, and I'll take you to your kids." Random thought. I wonder where Graham's wife is. I feel an overwhelming surge of pity for his sons raised by this man. but it's all fleeting because underneath that, I feel as cold and hard as the barrel of that shotgun, as much of a weapon. Because I'm not dying here. I'm not. I don't move much, and I make myself look weak, flailing, like I'm trying to obey him. I move my right hand and lift myself up to my knees, and as I come up, I smoothly, calmly raise the gun. He sees his mistake just before I fire. It's precise where I put the bullet. I don't go for the headshot or even for center mass. I go for the nerve plexus in Graham's right shoulder. He's a right-hander, like me. The bullet, a hollow point, goes in exactly where I want it. I can almost see the way it opens up on impact into a flesh-cutting scythe of destruction. It'll destroy his shoulder, sever nerves, break bones. A shoulder wound isn't the clean, simple thing they show in the movies and on television. You don't walk it off. Done right, a shoulder wound can take away use of that arm forever. And I've done it right. Graham's cry is short and sharp. He staggers back and tries to bring up the shotgun. And shock would have allowed for that, except that I'd destroyed nerve and muscle necessary to make the physics work. He drops it instead, and blindly fumbles for it with fingers that are no longer capable of picking it up. He's hurt, and hurt bad. But one thing about shoulder wounds that the silver screen gets right, it's probably not fatal. Not immediately, anyway. I roll to my feet. I feel warm now, loose and calm, the way I do at the range. Graham keeps trying to pick up the shotgun until I pull it away, and then he gives me a weird, tired grin.
"You fucking bitch," he says. "You were supposed to be easy."
"Gina Royal was easy," I tell him. "Tell me where they are."
"Fuck you."
"I let your boy go. I could have killed him." That registers a little. I see something move in his expression. It's just a twitch, but it's real. "I'll let you live if you tell me where my kids are. I don't want you dead."
"Fuck you. They aren't yours. They're his, and he wants them back. He needs them. This isn't about you, Gina."
"Okay," I tell him. I take a step to my right, and he takes a wary step the same direction, keeping in front of me. I do it again, and again. Until I'm the one with my back to the ridge, and he's got his back to the trail. We do this the hard way. He doesn't expect it when I step forward and push him, and he's clumsy with shock, slow to react. I'd never have tried it if he weren't already wounded, but it works perfectly. Graham staggers backward, and he screams. His feet go out from under him, and his weight falls back, and I see the bloody, sharp point of the branch I'd nearly impaled myself on earlier punch through him, at just about the level of his liver. Not an immediately fatal wound, but serious. Very serious. He flails and breaks the branch off. The mud doesn't do him any favors. He falls. He tries to grab the wood and pull it out, but there isn't much that's sticking out, and his right hand won't work properly.
"Get it out! Get it out!"
His voice has gone high and desperate.
"Jesus Christ!"
The rain's almost stopped now. He's writhing in the mud, fingers brushing that ugly, sharp point that's soaked with his blood, and I crouch down and put my gun to his head. "Jesus doesn't like it when you take his name in vain," I tell him. "And that didn't sound like a prayer. Tell me where my children are, and I'll get you help. If you don't, I'll leave you here. These woods have black bear, cougars, wild hogs. Won't take them long to find you." My arm hurts so bad now. It feels like it's been set on fire. I keep it steady despite that, because I must. Any show of weakness will be fatal. His face has gone starkly pale, luminous in the dark. I take the truck keys from his pocket. He has a hunting knife in a case, and I take it, too. I search in his pockets for his phone. It needs a thumbprint to unlock, and I take his wildly shaking right hand to press it in place. It doesn't work the first two tries as he tries to jerk away, but finally it's ready to use. "Last chance," I tell him as I pick up the shotgun. "Tell me where they are, and I'll save your life." His mouth opens, and I think for a second that he is going to tell me. He's scared, suddenly. Vulnerable. But he closes it again, without speaking, and just looks at me. And I wonder what has made him so afraid. Me? No. Melvin. Mel doesn't care if you live or die, I tell him. I mean it almost compassionately. Tell me, I can save you. I see the moment he breaks, the moment his fantasy disappears and the cold truth of his situation really hits him. Melvin Royal won't be coming for him. No one will. If I leave him here, he'll die of blood loss and the animals will tear him apart. Or, if he's not lucky, the order of that could be reversed. Nature's brutal. So am I, when I have to be.
There's a hunting cabin, he tells me. Up mountain. Belonged to my grandfather. They're in it.
He licks very pale lips.
My boys are watching them.
You son of a bitch! They're all just children! He doesn't answer that. I feel a surge of rage and weariness, and I just want this to be done. I turn away and make my way through the clinging mud toward the truck. He tries to get up, of course, but between the shoulder wound and that stab through the liver, he isn't going anywhere. The cold will help keep him alive for now. It'll slow blood loss. But as I climb into the truck and start it up, I scroll through the call list, looking for Kezia Claremont's number. I stop on the A list of names because right there at the top is one I recognize. It isn't common. I've never seen it before, except in the Bible. Absalom. It sinks in on me, then, the magnitude of the deception, the game. Absalom, the troll who'd become my constant ally. Absalom, who took my money and made my new identities, who could locate me at a moment's notice anywhere I ran, could direct me where he wanted me to go. It explained why we'd been looking the wrong way. Lancel Graham's family had been here for generations. His Stillhouse Lake home was a family heirloom, and Kezia and I had marked him off the list immediately as not a suspect. Hell, I'd even sent Absalom names to check out. He must have found it hilarious. He's never been helping me. He's been helping Melvin all this time, moving me like a chess piece, setting me up, knocking me down, putting me in the backyard of his copycat fanboy. I have to close my eyes for a moment to contain the incandescent rage that burns through me. But then I keep scrolling. I find Kezia's phone number and I dial. There are only two bars of connection, but the call completes. She's in a car. I can hear the engine noise just before she says carefully, Lance, Lance, I know. You need to let that woman go right now and tell me where you are. Lance, listen to me, okay? We can make this right. You know that needs to happen. Talk to me. I'd been afraid that she was part of it, too, but I hear the tense anger in her voice, though she's trying to hold it back. She's trying to talk him down. She's trying to save me. It's me, I say. It's Gwen. Jesus! I hear a confusion of noise, like she's nearly dropped the phone. I also hear another voice, male, but I can't make out what he's saying. Jesus, Gwen, where are you? Where the hell are you? Up on the ridge past Graham's house. We need an ambulance up here, I tell her. He's shot, and he has a stab wound in his side. I need police. He told me my kids are up in his grandfather's cabin. Do you know where it is? I'm shivering so hard my teeth are clacking together. The truck's engine has warmed a little, and the blast of the heater feels fantastic. I drag Kyle's down jacket over and put it over my shoulders. My left arm still burns, but when I look at it in the overhead light, I find the pellets haven't gone deep enough to do real damage. The wound to my head, though? I feel sick and weak and dizzy. The bleeding hasn't stopped. I reach up and feel the pulse of warm, watery blood coming from the slash in my scalp and fumble for tissues to press against it. I almost miss Kezia's reply. No, it isn't Kezia. It's Sam. He's in the car with her. Gwen, are you all right? Gwen! I'm okay, I lie. My kids, Graham's boys, are at that cabin, too. I don't know if they're armed, but... Don't you worry about that. We're coming to you right now, okay? Graham needs an ambulance. Fuck Graham, he says, and I hear the vicious edge in his voice. What about you? The tissues I've pressed to my wound are already a sodden mess. I might need stitches, I say. Sam, I'm here. Please. Please help me get the kids. They're going to be okay. We'll get them. You just stay there. Hang on. Kez has the location of the cabin. We're coming to you. It's all coming straight to you. Kezia is driving, and I've been in the car with her. She's using police tactics, driving with controlled wildness and tremendous speed. I look in the rearview mirror. I can see the headlights of a police cruiser swerving and speeding down the main road. I see them turn at the Johansson's cutoff. Sam's still talking, but I'm tired. The phone rests on my leg, though I'm not sure when I put it down. My aching, pulsing head is leaning against the window glass. I'm not shivering anymore. I say, "Get my kids." Or at least I think it, before everything goes very, very dark. 14. Gwen? My God! I open my eyes. Sam is crouched beside me, and he looks odd. He turns and says, "I need that first aid kit." Kezia is right behind him, and she dumps a large red bag beside him. He rips open the Velcro top and searches inside. "What are you doing?" I ask him. I'm not clear. I'm definitely not. But I've stopped hurting, mostly. Amazing what a little sleep will do. "I'm okay." "No, you're not. Quiet." He takes a thick pad of bandages and presses them tight to my head, and the pain comes back in a sullen roar. "Can you hold that for me? Hold it." He presses my hand to the pad, and I manage to do as he says, while he breaks out more bandages and wraps everything in place. "How much blood did you lose?"
"Lots," I tell him. "Doesn't matter. Where's the cabin?"
"You are not going to the cabin." I fumble for my gun. He effortlessly takes it away, empties the chamber, and strips the mag in one move, then tosses the pieces in the back seat of the SUV. "You are not going anywhere but to the hospital. You need x-rays on that skull. I don't like the look of that. You could have a depressed fracture."
"I don't care. I'm going.
And I will. In a minute." It seems a monumental effort to get out of the truck right now.
"Did you get my text?"
He gives me an odd look.
"When?" "Never mind."
Graham was successful in that. He'd managed to break my phone before the text got sent.
"How did you figure out he was bad?"
"He didn't show up for the search," Sam tells me. He's busy checking my eyes with a penlight, which is annoying and painful, and I try to bat him away. Kez did a little digging. Turns out he'd been gone a full day off work during the time of each abduction, and again on the days we figure he disposed of the bodies. She's been having a feeling about him for a while. When we found out he showed up at the station and gave you a ride...
"Thanks," I tell him.
He looks set and grimly angry. "Yeah, not like we got here in time to do much good rescuing you." I steal one of his hands that's probing my neck for injuries and hang on to it.
"Sam, thank you."
We look at each other for a few seconds, and then he nods and continues his evaluation. Kezia has gone to check on Graham. She comes back and takes the first aid kit, and soon after that I see the flashing signals of the ambulance. Out here in the sticks, the ambulance comes with four-wheel drive, which allows it to pull up past the truck and toward the trailhead, where I see Kezia tending to Graham in the wash of the headlights.
"Do you know where the cabin is?"
I ask Sam. He's found the pellets in my left arm.
"Please, I need to know."
"I'm fine, Sam. Leave it."
"You're not."
"Sam!" He sighs and sits back, hands on his thighs. "It's a long hike up, and you aren't up to it."
"I told you, I'm all right. Look."
I force myself into high gear, and I step out of the truck. I'm steady. I hold my hands out. No shakes.
"See?"
I'm a little shocked when he pulls me into a hug, but it feels good. It feels safe. I've trusted all the wrong people, and I pushed away all the right ones, and this upends everything I thought I knew about myself.
"You're not okay.
But I know you have to do this," he says. "I know you'll do it without me."
"Damn right I will," I tell him. "Give me back my gun."
He doesn't like it. He kisses me on the forehead just below where the bandages are wrapped and checks to make sure they're secure. Then he ducks in the back, puts the spare bullet in the mag, slaps my sig together, and hands it to me. I slide it in the pocket. The paramedics are working on Lancel Graham, but Kezia has left them to it, and she comes back to us. She has on her uniform under a thick coat and her gun strapped to her hip. She passes us and heads to her cruiser, where she opens up the trunk and takes out two bulletproof vests. She puts one over her head and carries the other over to us. She hands it to Sam. Sam puts it on me. When I start to protest, he shakes his head. No, just no. I let it pass. He and Kez get shotguns from the cruiser, and she has a supply kit that she slings over her head, bandolier style. Stuffed, I would bet, with survival supplies and ammunition. Kezia goes back to talk to the paramedics, then takes out her phone and makes a call. When she returns to us, she says, Prester's got backup coming, but it'll be a while for all the search parties to come back in and get over to us. He said to go ahead? Sam asks. She gives him arched eyebrows. Hell no, he didn't. He said wait. You wanna wait? He shakes his head. I say, which way is it? Sam's right. I'm not up to it, but that doesn't matter. I don't let my increasing dizziness slow me down, though Sam keeps a watchful eye on me. I feel smothered under the weight of the bulletproof vest strapped on under the down jacket. It's hot, and I'm sweating freely now. The night is still cold. My body's running at red line levels just to keep me moving up the hill. Kezia is as sure-footed as a cougar as she leads us up the trail, not the one I'd taken earlier, but the one I'd come slipping down. We pass the rock where I hit my head, and her flashlight shines on the wet, red glisten of my blood. There's a lot of it. She doesn't say anything. Neither does Sam, but he moves a step closer as we hike up. The trail breaks off to the northwest, still wandering upward. The lightning has stopped now, and the rain, too, but there's a wind kicking up through the trees that sways the pines overhead in a whispering dance. I find myself wanting to look behind me, in case Lancel Graham is creeping up. Graham's in the hospital. He'll be lucky if they can save his damn liver. But that doesn't stop me from imagining the horror show. Once, I see him. I'm starting to hallucinate. I can hear someone crying. Lanny. I can hear my daughter crying, and it makes me thin and raw inside, and I turn to Sam. The question is almost on my lips. Do you hear that? But I know he doesn't. I'm losing control. We come out half an hour later on a thin, slender shelf clear of trees. There's a tiny shack of a cabin squatting in the overhang of a rock ridge. It'd be almost invisible from overhead. You had to know this thing was here to find it at all. And it's old. Repairs have been made, but there's something old-time country about the construction. Kezia lights it up with her flashlight in a blue-white glare. Kyle and Lee Graham, come on out right now. This is Officer Claremont. She has a commanding voice, like a teacher calling out students for bad behavior, and I think it would have worked on me at that age. There's a flutter of movement at a curtained window, and then the door cracks and a boy yells, Where's my dad? Kezia steps forward and motions the two of us to stay back. Lee? Lee, you know me. Your dad's okay. He's on the way to the hospital. You come on out now. Look, I'm putting my gun away, okay? You come on out. The younger Graham boy slips out. He's wearing a coat too big for him, and he looks pale and scared. I didn't want to, he says in a rush. I didn't. I don't want to get in trouble. You won't, honey, you won't. You come on here. Kezia motions him forward, and once he's to her, she gestures to Sam, who comes forward, takes the boy by the elbow, and half drags him to where I stand. Lee opens his mouth to protest. I put a hand on his shoulder and crouch down to look him in the eye. Are my kids in there? I ask him. He finally nods. It wasn't my fault, he tells me. I told Kyle we shouldn't have, but... But you can't say no to your dad, I say, and I see the relief spread over his face, the trauma. And even though he stood between me and my own children, I want to hug him. I don't, but I feel how lost he is. I understand. It'll be okay. You just stay right here, sit down and don't move. Kezia has moved a little closer. Kyle, you need to come out. Can you hear me? Kyle. I turn to Lee, who's hunched in on himself now, not looking at the cabin or anybody. Lee, is your brother armed?
He has a rifle, he says. Don't hurt him. He's just doing what Dad told him.
I think it's more than that. Lancel Graham had trusted Kyle to sneak up on me in the dark. I wonder if Kyle has helped his father with anything else. He's big for his age, and handsome. He could have been a real asset in distracting a young woman before an abduction. I picture him going up to that girl in the parking lot of the bakery, leading her off to his dad's SUV. It makes me feel a spasm of disgust so strong it's like nausea. I tell Kezia that Kyle has a rifle, and she nods grimly. She's already eased her gun out of its holster. Get Sam to go round back. I don't want Kyle having another way out of this. You stay here with the boy. Sam's already on it, I see. He moves around the cabin between it and the rock face. I hope there aren't sleeping snakes back there, or worse. He doesn't come back, so I assume there is a door. I assume he's covering it. I tell Kezia, I'm going in. No, you're not, she says. She reaches out, but I'm already gone, walking straight for the door. I can see the curtain move. Kyle's watching me. I wonder academically if a rifle bullet will go through this vest. It might, at this range. Depends on the caliber and the grain. I have my SIG out of my pocket, and I hold it down, finger off the trigger as I try the door. It opens. Kyle hasn't thought to lock it after his brother left. Inside, it's very dark, except for a single guttering candle that sits on a rough table at the back of the room. The bitter, uncertain light flickers over Kyle, sitting on a bunk near the window. He has his rifle aimed straight at me. There's no one else in the cabin. No one. This is straight up a trap. I turn and yell, dodging out the door, and Kyle's shot misses me by fractions. I am moving toward Kezia, and behind her, I see Lee has moved from where I left him at the tree line. He's now standing in a perfectly learned shooting stance. He has a handgun that he's pulled from his pocket because I didn't search him. He was just a boy, and he's pointing it at Kezia's back. Lee! I scream, bringing my gun up. Don't do it! He's startled, and his shot goes wide, just barely wide. It shatters the window of the cabin, and Kezia turns low and fast. She advances on him with a stunning volley of shouts to drop the gun, drop the gun! And he does, convulsively throwing it away, and I spin back toward the cabin because Kyle is still in there, armed. And where are my children? God, please! Kyle throws open the door and aims the rifle straight at my face. I have time to react, to shoot, but I don't. I can't. He's a child. He's a stunted, twisted child. But I can't. Sam tackles him from behind and drives him face down into the mud. The rifle slides away and Kyle fights, screaming to get to it. Kezia has snapped handcuffs around his brother Lee's wrists, and she sits the boy down hard and takes out another pair. She lets out a shrill whistle and Sam looks up. She pitches and he plucks them out of the air and restrains him. He hauls the boy up and makes him kneel with his face against the cabin's wall. I can't breathe for the terror pounding through me. Not from the near miss. Not from Kyle and Lee. My kids have to be here. They have to be here. I run back into the cabin. It's tiny, barely big enough for a cot, a small table, a thick fleece rug, the open back door. I kick the rug away and uncover a trap door. I take the candle from the table and pull the handle on the trap door, and the cold, moist air that glides out makes the flame shiver uneasily. I wish for Kezia's powerful little flashlight, but only for a second. There's a wooden ladder leading down. I go. My arm doesn't like the strain, but I hardly notice the pain now. I still feel sick and dizzy, but it's not important. Nothing is important but what I will find here, under the earth. What I find is hell. I step into the past. There, ahead of me, as I turn from the ladder, is a metal stand with a winch attachment. The thick cable hanging from it ends in a loop. A noose. It's the same as the one in Melvin's garage, but it isn't just that. I recognize the tool shelves to the right, filled with parts, drills, vices. I recognize the red tool drawers that form a line across the top of a workbench. As I turn back toward the ladder, I recognize the pegboard that's been set up behind it, heavy with saws, knives, screwdrivers, hammers. There's a tray to the side with medical equipment, another that has a hunter's tools to flay the skin. And my gaze falls on the last perfect addition, the rug. It's the same style of rug that Melvin kept right below his victims, an incongruous little middle-class detail in a torture chamber. Graham has recreated Melvin's killing floor down to the last obsessive detail. The smell of this place makes me reel and put my shoulders against the ladder, because I know this smell. It had rolled out of my Wichita garage, spoiled meat and old blood, and the metallic stench of terror, and it is here in this place, exactly the same. I can't help it. I scream. I scream the names of my children as my heart breaks and my mind snaps and all I want to do is die. Graham never meant for them to live. He only meant for me to see this. I'm still holding the SIG, and for a terrible, beautiful moment of clarity, I think how perfect it is that I'm going to die here, in the same way that Gina Royal withered away and perished, looking at the same horrors, feeling the same sense of complete loss. And then I hear my son say, "Mom?" It's a whisper, but it is as loud as a shout, and I drop the gun, drop it like it's on fire, and I scramble on all fours across the floor, the rug, around the hulking horror of that winch, and behind it, I see the barred grate set into the false wall. It's padlocked. I stumble back to the tools and rip a crowbar out of the pegboard with such force I send things flying and clattering, and I run back to the door. I jam the forked end under the hasp and yank. Wood splinters, gives, the hasp tears free. I use the crowbar to lever the door, and inside I see Connor. I see Lanny. They are alive. Alive. And all the strength leaves me in that moment, and I crash to my knees as they rush toward me and throw themselves on me as if they want to disappear inside me. Oh, God, it's so beautiful. The relief hurts, but it's the hurt of a wound being cauterized, all the bleeding stopped. I am still rocking my children back and forth on the floor of this hell when Kezia and Sam find me. Both are breathless, braced for the worst. I see Sam's face and I think, my God, because he has just walked through a shrine to the place where his sister suffered and died, and I can only imagine how hard this has been, to take these steps past that winch and reach us. But we're alive. We're all alive. 15. The blood in my house, I find, was from Kyle, and it was Lanny's doing. "I heard them fighting," she tells me, once we're outside again in the clean night air. Kyle and Lee Graham are both tightly handcuffed, and Kezia has fastened them to a hook set into the cabin's wall. I can't imagine what it's for. I don't want to. I grabbed the knife, and I came in, and I cut him. Kyle, I mean. I would have got him, too, if his damn dad hadn't been with him. I got us to the panic room just like you taught us. But he knew the code. I'm sorry, Mom. I let you down. No, I did. Connor's voice is a bare whisper, almost pulled away by the wind. The code was in my phone. I should have said so. You could have changed it. It all fits together now. Connor's phone, taken from him by Graham's kids. I remember my son's hesitance the night Graham brought the phone back, how Connor had almost told me something important. He hadn't wanted to make me mad because I'd told him over and over again not to write the codes down. I can't let him believe this is his fault. Ever. No, baby, I tell him. I kiss his forehead. It doesn't matter. I'm so proud of you both. You stayed alive. Right now, that's what matters, okay? We're alive. Kezia has got foil blankets in her survival kit, and I wrap the kids up to preserve their body heat. They're bruised. They took a beating in the fight. I ask if there's anything they want to tell me about what happened at the cabin. Lanny says nothing happened. Connor says nothing at all. I wonder if my daughter is lying to me. We sit in the clearing. Backup finally arrives in a swarm of NPD uniforms, and I see Javier Esperanza's there, too. He nods to me, and I nod back. I doubted him. I never should have. Detective Prester himself has made the climb. He's still got a suit that's never going to survive this mud, but he's thrown on a heavy pea jacket. He comes immediately to us, and I see something new in his face. Respect.
I owe you one hell of an apology, Miss Proctor, he says.